friend of mine.
I convene the finance committee.
We're a little short of a quorum, but we do have two testifiers, and then we have two bills up this morning. We have to be done by noon, so we'll get started. And if Larry Isaacs would be willing to come forward with the Midwest Higher Education contact, and just would like to mention as you come forward, the committee isn't at full strength yet. There will be others joining us. I may stop at some point and officially convene the meeting. But by way of a little bit of background, members, I have served for a number of years as both a MAC commissioner and an alternate to MAC, actually going back to the very beginning. And one of the things that MAC has done is provide opportunities for the member states in a variety of ways, but one of them happens to be a number of activities that are available that can be purchased through MAC. And even though it says the Midwest Higher Education Compact, many of the services that they have available are available to school districts, counties, cities, and so on. Representative Rukavina happens to serve as one of the commissioners as well, and so he would have a base knowledge of what's available relative to higher education. But I've asked Mr. Isaacs and staff to be here to talk about it in the broadest sense, so that the other division chairs and so on would be available, or would have available to them that knowledge. As you know, the governor has talked about joint opportunities working with other states, and as soon as that announcement was made, the first thing that I happened to think about was MAC. But we will be following Larry Isaacs' testimony by Commissioner Dan McElroy on some other things that are being done and worked on by the state of Minnesota with our neighbors. Mr. Isaacs?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Larry Isaac. I'm president of the Midwestern Higher Education Compact. Joining me at the table here today is Rob Trembeth, vice president and legal counsel for the compact, and also Grant Crawford, who is our chief information officer and works on many of our technology programs. We appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. I hope I can make it through this. The last couple of days, I developed what's going around, as you can probably tell from my voice. Rob, if I start to really get into a coughing fit, I know you'll fill in for me. You have in front of you a portfolio with MEC on the front, Midwestern Higher Education Compact, and inside you have a document that looks like this that I'm going to just briefly go through to give you an overview of the compact with a focus on our cost savings programs for our member states. This compact was created in 1991, and it was an outgrowth of the Midwestern Legislative Conference, of which Minnesota is a member, and there were several Minnesota legislators at that time who were instrumental in creating the compact, Representative Carlson among them. In fact, Representative Carlson was the second chair of the compact back in the mid-90s. So Minnesota has shaped the compact very well. And at that time, actually, the compact decided to locate its offices here in the Twin Cities. And so we are located in an office in the West Bank office building at the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota put quite a pitch on to the commission at that time. And so we are delighted to be here. I became the president about 5.5 years ago after serving as chancellor of the university system in North Dakota for 10 years. And so we had a lot to do with Minnesota, so it was a great place to come. There are 12 states in the compact. As you can see on the map, on the slide on the bottom of the page, basically covering the same Midwestern area as the Midwest Legislative Conference. All 12 states are members. All 12 states have passed statutes to become members. So this is a true interstate compact in the sense that each state has passed a statute to become a member of the compact. That statute is very critical to us, and I'll talk to you about that in just a little bit. All of our services are available to both public and not-for-profit higher education institutions in the Midwest. There's over 1,000 of those. And as Representative Carlson said, and I'll go into in a little bit, several of our programs are also available to school districts and local governments as well. We are governed by a commission that's comprised of 5 people from each state as required by the statute. Generally, 3 are appointed by the governors of those states, and the statutes also require that 2 be from the legislative branch, 1 from the House and 1 from the Senate. The commission is governed by this 60-member body, and I think that's the real strength of it, in that it really brings together a very diverse group of people in the governance and direction of what we do in the compact. You can see on the bottom of slide 4 who the commissioners are from your state that are serving right now, as well as the alternate commissioners. Our core function is identified by the...
I may stop on officially convening the meeting. We do now have a quorum present, and Representative Champion, would you care to move the minutes?
I move the minutes.
Okay, the March 9th.
March 9th minutes.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Mr. Isaacs, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 5, you'll see our statute that all the states have passed, plus the bylaws of the commission as passed by the commission, state that our core mission, our overall mission, is to advance cooperation and collaboration and resource sharing in higher education. And we do that through 3 different functions that we call cost-saving, student access, and policy research, all of these guided by people from the states. We're a small staff, but we rely heavily on up to 150 to 200 volunteer people from across the Midwest working on these committees and guiding our programs. Early on, the commission decided that it wanted this compact involved in resource sharing in a very significant way. And so this compact has developed a niche, really nationally, in terms of providing what we call cost savings or resource sharing, using the leverage of those 12 states, if you will, to get good buys, to do joint purchasing, and to drive down costs. The focus that the compact has taken on over the years, and it's been in and out of a number of programs, from telecommunications to equipment maintenance, one time looked at natural gas purchasing, and it's been in and out of a number of things. Presently, the focus is on risk management and technology, with a couple of exciting areas just coming on board that I'll talk about in a bit. But what we do in these 2 areas is very significant. And last year, if you look at slide number 7, you will see that these programs saved the 12 states, the entities in the 12 states that use them, about $31 million. Now, we're pretty conservative on how we estimate those savings. On our technology, for example, we use 9%. We don't compare it to the catalog price and some of those things. We try to be conservative. In technology, we had over $200 million of purchases last year off of this contract by higher education entities and state and local governments, a lot of that in local governments and school districts. Our property insurance program now insures $62 billion of property insurance at over 100 campuses in the Midwest. In Minnesota, that includes the University of Minnesota and a couple of private institutions as well. Those values for those institutions, $8.6 billion of property in Minnesota is insured through this program. This has been a very significant and successful program for the compact. Now, the statute I talked about earlier that all the states have passed is significant because that statute permits the compact to negotiate on behalf of the states and for the states and the entities in the states to use those contracts. It creates MEC as a body corporate of each state, and so it allows, because of that, it permits MEC to negotiate those contracts and then for states and entities therein to use those. In Minnesota last year, as I said, the insurance program is used by the University of Minnesota and a couple of private institutions. The technology program is used by a variety of entities, school districts, local governments. You'll see there about 100 state and local governments and 73 school districts purchased off of the program. If you look on the back right-hand side of your portfolio, you'll see a listing of entities that in your portfolio on the right-hand side. There's a sheet in back, if you pull it out, that shows the entities in Minnesota that used our technology contracts during the past year, and I'm sure there's some perhaps in one of your districts that used it. The chart on page 9 will show you what the usage has been in Minnesota, the savings over the last 5 years from the use of these programs, and you'll see that it is growing in most areas, a couple of areas we've gotten out of. But last year, the savings overall were about $2.2 million for the region. Now, each state pays a membership fee. That's part of our financing, part of our budget of $95,000 per year. And when you look at the return on the savings in Minnesota, that's about a 25-to-1 ratio, which we think is pretty good, especially in the times that we're in now. There's some more schedules on pages 10 and 11 shows all of the states and how they've used the cost savings programs in the last 12 months and over the years. Totally, since Minnesota became a member in 1990-91, entities and individuals have saved about $26 million using MEC's cost savings program. And overall, entities across the Midwest have saved about $354 million. So, it's a record that the compact can be, I think, pleased with, and thanks to our commissioners, they're the ones that early on said, we want this commission to be involved in this activity, and it looks like their decision at that time was a good one. Now, on slide 12, there are two areas that our commission has encouraged us over the years to become involved in, and that's in energy and in health benefits. And we were pleased that last fall we received a $800,000 grant from the Lumina Foundation for Education to explore these two areas in terms of how can we do things as a region that might lower costs in these areas. So we have formed two committees that are just becoming very active right now to start looking into this. They're doing surveying of institutions across the Midwest about usage in these areas. And then we hope that within a year we'll have some programs that we can begin to roll out in these areas that institutions and entities in the Midwest can start to take advantage of. May or may not be on the buy on energy, but it could be on conservation projects and measures and contracts with companies like Johnson Control or something like that. In health benefits, we have some institutions in the Midwest that are doing some very good things in pharmaceuticals, for example. Maybe we could expand that across the Midwest. There's some thought that maybe we could do something on a regional level for student health insurance. For those students that have to pay for health insurance on their own, there may be some thoughts that we could do something to drive down costs there. So those are just a couple of ideas that have come to the forefront early on, and there will be many more as we move into that, into those programs. Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to spend as much time on the other two core functions, but let me just say that in addition to the cost savings, we have what we call a student access function, trying to find ways for students to make it more convenient and easier for them to attend college. As you know, that's going to become more and more critical in terms of meeting our workforce needs in the future. We have a student exchange program that Minnesota has participated in. This is voluntary for institutions to participate in and for states to participate in. And Minnesota has participated in this over the years, and its students have saved just under $5 million. What it does is institutions are allowed to charge no more than 150% of resident tuition. So some institutions will charge 125%, some might charge 100%, some might charge 150%. They can put one program in, all their programs, set admissions limits, criteria, whatever. It's used in a variety of ways as an enrollment management tool. In Minnesota, you take in just about 600 students and you send out about 200 students under this program. But those 200 students save a lot of money by using it. On the bottom of page 15, Minnesota has been one of the first of our states to begin using our electronic transcript program. And it's projected that in the coming year, about 25,000 transcripts will be sent using that program here in Minnesota. Many other states are starting to look at this now. Just an easier way for students to get their transcripts to colleges and in a more convenient, faster, and of course much more efficient way. The last area, Mr. Chairman, that we focus on, that the compact has encouraged us to and asked us and directed us really to be involved in, is policy research. We do a number of things in there. For those of you that are in policy, there is a website that's called PERL, P-E-R-L, that I would encourage you or your staff to take a look at if you're researching any issue on education and particularly higher education that can give you a vast array of resources at your fingertips. It's a library, if you will, of resources. I would encourage you to use it. We do a number of other things, and some of you have been involved in these activities in terms of policy summits. We try to put out a signature study every year. Last year we did one on campus safety and security. It received a lot of attention and has been used quite extensively by boards and institutions across the country. Also, we track a number of policy indicators for every state. Those are laid out on slides 18, 19, and 20. I'm not going to go through those, Mr. Chairman, because I know you wanted me to focus on the cost savings part. But there may be some things in there that will affirm things you know. There may be some new things that might guide you in terms of some policy discussions here in Minnesota about how you stack up with other states and nationally. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to conclude and be available for any questions.
And just a quick comment. A number of years ago when we first had the property insurance program, I had a conversation with some folks from U of M, and their comment was, well, we're a very large institution, we get very good bids. They're now getting their property insurance through MEC, and could you comment about any claims they might have had and what happened? Because I think there was an advantage to being
very much
a very broad base with potentially 900 institutions, although I think we're showing that 100 is actually signed up.
Yes. The University of Minnesota has been a member of that program for a number of years. You'll recall that there's been a couple of losses over the past few years at the U that were significant. In fact, the U has had the most significant losses of any member in the program over the years, and there might have been a time 5 or 6 years ago where it might have even been difficult for the university to get property insurance at any kind of a reasonable rate because of that loss history. Thank goodness in the last few years the loss history has been better, so the rates are coming down. But they've been a part of this program, and a couple of years ago the carrier that we have for the primary layer here, there's a self-insurance layer and then an insured layer with a carrier, came to the committee that oversees this of people from all of the institutions and said, well, there's a couple of institutions, the University of Minnesota and Eastern Illinois, that have had some particularly large losses in the last couple of years, and we think that because of that those two should have a 15% rate increase, when the others were being asked to, we're going to get a 1% increase, I think it was at that time. The rest of the people in that group from across the Midwest, institutions from across the Midwest, from Michigan to Missouri, said, no, we don't want to do that. We could be in the same boat someday. We're all going to be treated alike, and everybody took a 2% rate increase, including the University of Minnesota. It saved them $300,000 that year by being part of the program, just by that action alone of banding together. And so I think that shows you the kind of commitment that there are of institutions to that program.
Okay, as we move to questions, Rob Chernoff, if you feel free to chime in, and then Mr. Crawford as well. In fact, if you want to move a chair forward, you're fine where you're at. Okay. Representative Hausman, I think you had your hand up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you built in anything to assure that as this grows, your central bureaucracy doesn't grow and eat up part of the savings? Is there kind of a conscious decision to limit bureaucracy?
Right.
Mr. Chairman, we've always tried to, our philosophy has been, and that of the commission has been, to try and maintain a small staff and use volunteers out there significantly. We have, I think, 9.5 FTE total for all the things we do. So we are committed to maintaining a small staff. Now, you have to balance that. If things continue to grow, or if there are new opportunities that you can take advantage on, then we may have to say, okay, well, we may need some employment. But, for example, what we're doing on energy and health insurance right now is we're hiring on those experts in the field to guide those, not employees, but consultants, if you will, to really that have expertise in the field to get those things going and started, and then we'll see 3 years down the road from now whether we actually need anybody on board to do that or whether the committees can pick up the load just fine and not put on a permanent person to get it going. So we use a pretty conservative philosophy in that regard, and I think our commission would want us to continue to do that.
And then, Mr. Chair, specifically to the health cost savings, I think you mentioned, you just mentioned insurance, and you mentioned, I think, pharmaceuticals earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Have you explored self-insurance? You've got a pretty large group, and a company like 3M has discovered cost savings, significant cost savings when they move in the direction of self-insurance. Are you open to that?
I'm going to ask Rob to answer that. He's working with that committee.
Just identify yourself for the record as well.
Rob Trembath, the Vice President and General Counsel for the Compact. That is one issue that will be on the table discussed. The problems that may be to start out with something like that is you have to have the commitments up front to make that happen from the institutions, and they're going to need to see that there's quantifiable savings from what they're currently doing in order to be willing to jump into something like that. But that is certainly something that will be discussed.
Okay, there are other questions? I have one, and that's, as I mentioned, I wanted the focus today to be on what's available for other units of government outside of higher education. And Representative Rukavina is here, and as I mentioned earlier, is a commissioner, and I think our higher education community is fairly well informed. What can be done to better inform the school districts and the counties and cities as to what might be available through NEC? Because we've really put on the front burner, if you will, the full idea of joint purchasing and potential cost savings, if for no other reason the budget problems that we're currently going through.
Well, I think that's an area that we are always encouraged in every state we go to is to get better known. So we are exploring right now, actually doing some things to try to make that happen, looking at actually some direct mailings. And some said, well, why don't you do emails? Well, if you're like me, you get a lot of emails, and that delete button gets pretty handy without taking a look at what's there sometimes. So we are trying to find ways where we can get something directly into the hands of superintendents and others to become more aware of our program. You all can be very helpful in that as well, Mr. Chairman, in in helping to notify and let your school districts that are in your district know about the compact and its availability to them. They can go right online and make, we don't get involved at all in the purchases, for example, of computer hardware. They can go right online to any one of the vendors and boom, they're out there to do it. They don't have to bid. It cuts down on bidding costs and time, and many school districts perhaps don't have the professional staff that would do bidding like a larger school district might or a university. And so they can go right to our website and get right into it and do any purchasing they want. It's also available to faculty of school districts and higher education institutions and staff. They can use it. Legislators, as state, I guess state employees in a sense, can use it, and anyone else. So we're looking at ways that we can get the word out more broadly than we've been able to in the past, and those are some of the ideas.
When I was looking at the list here of school districts that have participated in the hardware purchases, I happen to represent mainly the Robbinsdale School District is within my district, but I also happen to represent part of the Hopkins School District, and I see they're on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we do have the Robbinsdale School District represented here today listening. I don't know if there are any others in the audience or not, but there is a lot of potential here.
Yeah.
And so in Robbinsdale would be a district, what are we, about 12,000 students, I think, now, so that would be a... And I think Hopkins is about 7,000. But there are some large and small districts that are already participating. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I could make one more comment. I know you are all looking at ways, and every state is looking at ways to reduce costs through joint purchasing in some way or another. We are just pleased that we can be another option for them. We try very hard not to duplicate what states can already do on their own. And we try to add value where we can and provide broader options to folks. And many times our programs are for those broader options. If you're going to go out and guarantee a buy of 1,000 computers, you can probably get a better deal if you do that. But if you're going to go out and buy 5 or 6, we might be a better deal. That's where we get a lot of business. And so we want to continue to be an option, not a duplication of what already can be done. We do some good things here in Minnesota. We've met with the Department of Administration about a month ago when Governor Pawlenty and Governor Doyle announced their initiative. I wrote to both of those. Governor Pawlenty wrote back to me and said he was pleased that we had done that. And so we will continue to find ways to work with entities. And if the states are doing some really good things or institutions are doing some really good things that we could broaden even more effectively across the region, we can become a mechanism for that as well. So if there are things that you are aware of that we could take and broaden and maybe even do a little better on, please notify us. We'd be glad to take a look at it.
Very good. Rest in time.
We noted the fact that this is more advantageous for smaller districts than large districts. But do you ever compare the results that you're getting with, say, the large districts that aren't in this to see if there's some, just to see who's in either direction? If you're doing better than they are, then why aren't they joining you? Or if they're doing better than you, then why aren't you doing as well as them? But what?
Mr. Chairman, we do that on an occasional basis, but we don't do a regular study of everybody's contracts. And it can vary from day to day, even on hardware, with these hardware contracts with companies like Dell in terms of what they're posting here or there. No, we don't do it on a regular basis. We do it on a kind of a case-by-case basis as things come along.
Any other questions? Well, thank you, Mr. Isaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we now have Commissioner McElroy. And welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Your comments, by the way, are going to be a little bit broader than what Mr. Isaacs were, but if you can focus to some degree on the purchasing part of it as well.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. My name is Dan McElroy, and I'm Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, but I'm here in a slightly different role. The Governor's office asked me to assist in coordinating and providing some communication in an effort that Governor Pawlenty and Governor Doyle launched in January of this year to explore additional opportunities for collaboration between the executive branches of government in our two states. That took the form of an executive order that was issued on January 13th. Each of the agencies in both states, cabinet commissioners in Minnesota, cabinet secretaries in Wisconsin, were asked to work with teams from their agencies and our counterparts in Wisconsin and report back to the governor by the end of February. Those reports are in and now being examined, so what I'm going to talk about is somewhat preliminary. We expect the two governors to meet in the next few weeks, and there will probably be more announcements based on that work. I want to thank everybody who's been involved in this. It was a lot of trips back and forth and a lot of conference calls. There are about 24 cabinet agencies in Minnesota, and then some agencies that wouldn't have to have participated chose to do so. The Gambling Control Commission, the Racing Commission, and the Minnesota Lottery explored options with their counterparts in Wisconsin as well. The results that have been reported back to us break down into five categories of opportunity. And I want to stress that this is the beginning of a process. This isn't an event of talking to each other. We've gotten to know some people, and there's some ongoing opportunities. I expect this to be an ongoing process. But the five categories roughly come down to these. One are opportunities to share facilities, services, to help each other along the extensive border. What we're calling kind of border zone opportunities, and there are quite a few. The Departments of Transportation and Public Safety are looking at sharing radio tower communications so we don't have to duplicate those along the border. The housing finance agencies in the two states have some obligations to inspect multifamily principally, and they're looking at collaborating and sharing some of those inspections across the border. Labor and industry is discussing working with their counterparts on amusement ride inspections, which are required in both states, but in border communities perhaps can give better service if we do it reciprocally. Public safety and DNR already have joint powers and joint support agreements, but we are looking at ways to make those even more robust. Our agency, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, has two counterpart agencies, almost two and a half counterpart agencies. Wisconsin is organized with workforce programs in their Department of Workforce Services, which also has many of the programs that here are organized in labor and industry. Their Department of Commerce has economic development, and they have a separate Department of Higher Education and Public Facilities Finance. It's a little like our PFA and our Higher Education Facilities Board combined. We're looking at ways to assist customers in vocational rehabilitation and state services for the blind who live on the border and do it collaboratively. And we think that that will improve service and potentially reduce some costs. Second to general category, and following up on what Mr. Isaacs was talking about and on the focus of this hearing, was strength to purchasing opportunities. I want to make clear there's already a great deal going on and has been for some time. This is not a new area. And like Mr. Isaacs' testimony, it wasn't the desire of the two governors to repeat or overlap what was already happening, but to explore new options. And some were found that were very interesting. The one that I find kind of most intriguing is the two departments of corrections are looking at coordinating the menus of what they serve prisoners in their respective institutions so they would have the same menus in all of their institutions and buy groceries collaboratively so that Wisconsin has, I think, 27 facilities, and we have 7 or 8, and they would have the same menus on any given day. That seemed creative to us. They already do some collaboration on healthcare and pharmaceuticals, but have more opportunities there. The two departments of natural resources are looking at potentially buying from each other nursery stock and fisheries stock and being more efficient in that. The Department of Transportation is looking either at buying separately but together, buying equipment, or even sharing jointly very specialized equipment for the inspection of bridges. So it is both a purchasing opportunity potentially and a shared equipment opportunity. There are a number of other shared equipment opportunities that are being explored. The Department of Administration has long been the focus in Minnesota on our shared purchasing efforts. They do some of the things like Mr. Isaacs was talking about and some that are different. But they've been working with a wide variety of other agencies, including virtually all the agencies of state government, to continue looking for ways to buy things together. More so on kind of physical materials as opposed to services, but not ignoring services either. Third major category of potential collaboration is in information technology. Some of that may include the purchasing of software or hardware, but we looked more at the opportunity to share systems. For example, Minnesota implemented a new unemployment insurance system, and Wisconsin has not yet done that. There have been conference calls almost every week as to ways that we may be able to collaborate or they may be able to use. We may be able to share some of that. Wisconsin has automated the process. When you sign up for unemployment insurance in Wisconsin, you're automatically registered in their equivalent of Minnesota Works. We had not done that and would likely be able to use some of the work that they had done, and we're excited about that. The two corrections departments will likely use a common RFP. They are required under federal law now to get electronic medical records for prisoners. They likely will do that together. The Departments of Education, now this started, when I wrote this, I thought this was just Minnesota and Wisconsin. There are now six states that are working on a multi-state test bank so that things that are developed in one state can be accessible in other states. That hasn't happened yet, but is in the development stages. The two departments of health are working on electronic laboratory reporting, both to cross-utilize systems and potentially share information. There is a potential collaboration on emergency backup data centers. This is a bigger undertaking. In Wisconsin, our equivalent of the Office of Enterprise Technology is organized as part of the Department of Administration, and they have a CIO, but not at the cabinet level. They have more data centers than we do. But there is a discussion going on about how we can back each other up for emergency preparedness. There is also a great deal of exchange of best practices, including between the Department of Revenue, the Departments of Commerce, the Departments of Administration, and our agencies as to computer systems. One small example, we both administer a federal tax credit called the Work Opportunity Tax Credit. We have had the database that's required automated, but not the application. Wisconsin has the application automated, but not the database. We're going to trade. It will result in avoided costs and improved service and speed up the process. The fourth category is in the area of joint training. For example, our gambling control commissions use the same, they're called totalizers, the same our mutual tracking software. They're going to share training. Our agency is looking at sharing training in voc rehab and state services for the blind, not on a statewide basis, but potentially on a regional basis. There is some discussion of specialized law enforcement and corrections staff training, and the Departments of Human Service have an interest in sharing child welfare training. The fifth category has to only be described as other or miscellaneous. There were some opportunities identified that didn't fit neatly in the other four categories. Those include the Department of Agriculture considering opportunities in the area of invasive pest control. And this, the most visible right now will be soybean rust or the emerald ash borer, but this could be an exchange of surveillance, communications, pesticide research, a variety of things. I don't know quite how far they are able to go on that, and some of the things they want to do may require legislation in both states. The Department of Commerce are exploring ways to share actuarial services between the two states. You know, the life expectancy in the two states is probably the same. The impact on insurance companies is probably the same. For us to completely redo all the actuarial studies may not be efficient or effective or necessary, and this was kind of an eye-opener for both the departments. There is also the Department of Corrections in both states, along with, and interestingly, the Attorney General's office works much different in Wisconsin than it does here. The Attorney General is the Commissioner of the Department of Justice or the Secretary of the Department of Justice. There's a lot of discussion going on about ways to streamline extradition between the two states. In Minnesota, that has been principally led by the Department of Corrections with consultation with our Attorney General. The Departments of Natural Resources are exploring shared fish production for the stocking and fingerling. likely to be that we would provide some species and Wisconsin would provide others. And the Departments of Revenue are discussing a joint effort on income tax auditing and tax operations for individuals who live in one state and work in the other and currently could be potentially subject to being audited in both states. And we don't think that makes a lot of sense since we have reciprocity on the individual income tax, and it's kind of a common sense improvement, it looks like to us. Some of these can be done administratively. Some will require legislation. The audit interchange requires legislation. Legislation is likely to come in the next legislative session because of the timing. These discussions have happened at a time when both states were working on biennial budgets and also on the, implementing federal stimulus. So it's gone, very honestly, just a trifle slower than I would have hoped, but it, a lot has happened in about in a little less than 2 months. We've discovered that there are opportunities. There's been a very high level of cooperation in the event, in the discussions that I have participated in. And, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to take any questions that members might have.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McElroy, does the reciprocity work across subject areas? In other words, if Wisconsin spent a little bit more on amusement park infections, would we then have to spend a little bit more on invasive species monitoring, or how does that...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, we haven't gotten quite that far in the discussion. The agreements, letters of understanding are likely to be between agencies, and at least in the discussions I've been in, we think that they can balance reasonably fairly within agencies. And, you know, we may have differences in different years, but in terms of each subject matter, some of the invasive species does require legislation, so that would be an opportunity for the subject matter committee in both bodies to ask those questions of the respective chairs.
Could I ask Representative
Senate? Yes. When you referenced agriculture and then things like fishing stock, do you engage the scientific community? And the reason that I perked up when you mentioned fishing stock, along with at least two others of this committee, I happen to serve on LCCMR. And when we were up at, I think it was either Leech Lake or Red Lake, I forget which one, but learned that a walleye is not necessarily a walleye. There are genetic differences, and it often depends upon either what lake or what chain of lakes that fish has been in. So I guess that would be a yes or no if you engage the scientific community or others when you're talking about invasive species and even the restocking of fish from one state to another.
Mr. Chairman, the commissioners in those subject areas have been very cautious in that respect. I wasn't aware of the genetic differences between walleyes, but the Department of the DNR, for example, has a fisheries division that has a significant number of biologists involved. And the each agency is going through their own due diligence as to what collaboration, what issues might be raised by collaboration.
Okay, Representative Mulgania.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a note for the record that part of the governor's budget recommendation was to reduce some of the work on science that looks at the genetics of fish and make sure that the genetics are appropriate.
And I have one other. Were you going to comment on?
It's okay. Good information for me. I was not aware of that. I'm sure that the commissioners who are involved are aware of it, but I make a note.
Now, most of your comments, if not all, dealt with Minnesota, Wisconsin. Any work being done with the Dakotas or Iowa?
Mr. Chairman, not on as formal a basis as this, where we've had an active interchange of commissioners. There are a number of interstate efforts. The Higher Education Compact is just one of them. The Department of Administration works with states around us. Department of Education tells me there are now six states involved in that test bank. Our agency has been in contact, will be in contact a lot more on flood preparation with our counterparts in North Dakota and work with them on a number of other issues, but not as formally as we have with Wisconsin.
Okay. I see no other questions, so right. Thank you, Commissioner McElroy. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacs and Rob Trimble and Grant Crawford. We didn't
have an opportunity to hear from you, but thank you for being available. With that, as I mentioned at the beginning, some of you came in, the main idea was to make members, as we're working on the various budgets and so on, aware that there are things going on, and in the case of MEC, that there are opportunities that are available beyond higher education, was the main thrust of what I was trying to get across, the school districts and counties and cities would have available those opportunities for joint purchasing as well. We'll now go to the two bills that we have on the agenda. The first is House File 72 by Representative Norton. Oh, here we are. And we'll need a couple of motions, Representative Rukmina.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll move the first. I'll move the Higher Education Workforce Development Policy and Finance Division report, File 72. And then, is that a?
Yeah, we'll take that. We'll vote on that. And any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Rukadeva,
and then I'll move the bill. I'll move House File 72, Mr. Chair, and I believe it has to go to taxes.
I recommend it pass and be referred to taxes. Representative Norton on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I appreciate your hearing House File 72, which is about lifelong learning accounts. This bill was given some preliminary hearings last year when Representative and Speaker Kelleher and Representative Paulson carried the bill. After attending the Women in Government higher ed meetings this summer with Senator Sharon and Representative Kahn, I was compelled to move the bill forward. Lifelong learning accounts are employer-matched, portable, individual accounts to finance employee education and training. They're known as LILA accounts, and they are a co-investment strategy which have been successfully piloted around the country since about 2001. Too often, we see investments in our children's education as a public good, but investment in adult learning as a private good. Given our changing demographics and our shrinking younger work pool and the trend toward multiple job changes for employees, it's time we change that mindset. According to a 2002 Hudson Institute study, 60% of the newly created jobs require skills that only 20% of U.S. workers possess. Estimates suggest that by 2014, the U.S. labor force will be short 9 million college-educated workers, including 3 million associate degree holders. This shortage of skilled workers is likely to increase as baby boomers begin to retire. We must be prepared to educate adult workers who have only a high school diploma, which in the handout you see is about 26% in Minnesota, to re-educate the adult workers that have some, but not all of a degree, which is another 23% of Minnesotans, and or retrain and re-educate adult workers who want or must prepare for a different job. LILAs are a great way to encourage all workers to learn new skills and be a vital part of our workforce. LILA accounts have some key components that are worth mentioning. Portability. The account stays with the employee, not the employer. They're broad in scope. They're not limited to one type of training or education. They're targeted in this bill toward industries that are projected to have high occupational openings and industry growth in the coming years, such as healthcare, hospitality workers, and technology. And the encouragement for low-skilled and lower-income workers to be re-educated or get further education in those areas. For employers, LILAs can help defray training and development costs or act as an affordable addition to an existing benefit package. For employees, LILAs can help frontline employees attain the key training that they need to advance their career or remain viable employees in a changing market. I understand that there'll be some concerns because this bill does have a tax credit in it, and I'm looking forward to a vigorous discussion in the tax committee on that very subject. I think some points about the bill. The actual deposits on the account are pre-tax, not tax-free. In fact, if you take the money out early, there is a penalty. The earnings on the account are tax-free if they're used for their intended purpose, which is the employee education. Friends and family contributions are not allowed to qualify for the tax credit. Both the employee and the employee are entitled to a small tax credit. The accounts are likened in many states to 401ks or 529 plans, which we have for children, education, and their investment in their futures. We have met with Deed, and they're raising no objections to the bill at this time that I'm aware of, and in the future committee, we'll have IBM and High Tech Minnesota come testify as to IBM has actually moved ahead with this for some of its employees already. We would like to see this type of initiative more broadly applied to other businesses, large and small, in the state of Minnesota. I think there's flexibility and changes that can be made to the bill if we have to in tax committee with regard to how quickly we implement this, and I know that's something Deed is feeling very positive about, that we're at least open to that, and I would entertain any questions that you might have.
The other questions, Representative Norton. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton. I'm just wondering if you have any fiscal data. Is there a fiscal note, or do you have any information available yet on what this is going to cost us?
Thank you, Representative Pepin and Mr. Chair. We do not yet have a fiscal note. I know it's going to be somewhat tough to do that because it's voluntary, but I'm sure that those folks that do that will come up with some numbers between now and taxes, and you're right, that will be the challenge in these tough times.
I might interject. This committee deals with fiscal notes, but when it goes to the tax committee, that they'll be requesting a what they call a revenue note. So once it gets there, that's one of the things that becomes part of their committee work if they have a hearing on the bill or when they have a hearing on the bill.
And Mr. Chair, frankly, our biggest challenge.
Okay, other questions? Well, seeing none, then Representative Rukavina renews his motion that House File 72 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. We now have House File 619 by Representative Hornstein. Okay, we're looking for Representative Hornstein right now. Do we have a member of the Transportation Committee here? Representative Hausman, would you care to move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, is there a committee? I move the Transportation Policy and Finance Division report for House File 619.
Okay, the division report is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. We can take care of all the preliminaries, I guess, and if we can't find him, then we'll just lay it over.
And I move that File 757 be recommended to pass and place on the General Register. And I will just say, Mr. Chair, I was in attendance when this was discussed, and there was no opposition. I think, it comes from the Department of Public Safety, so it's a department bill.
Yeah, it's a technical bill. Is anybody here from the department? Could you come forward? We don't have the author. We'll do something a little unique. We'll have you tell us what the bill is about, and it would be rather rare that we would take action on a bill without the author present, but we can at least get your comments out of the way and have an understanding of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And this bill is technical in nature. In 2005, as you might remember, DDS was authorized to become a fee-based budget rather than getting appropriations from the trunk highway system and budget, as well as from the highway user tax distribution funds. We now operate by spending the fees that we are able to get for our various services. And at the time, we had established that the IFTA DPAL, which is the International Fuel Tax Agreement, and that's where we participate with all jurisdictions to collect fuel taxes for motor carriers from our that register in our base state. And those fuel taxes are then distributed among any state that motor carrier goes through. And we do that on a monthly basis. We distribute the funds that we receive. So we have a decal that needs to be on all motor carriers stating that they are participating in that fuel tax agreement. And the decal fee is $2.50. but inadvertently we didn't realize that there was still an administrative rule in place that only charged 50 cents for the decal, and so what we're requesting is that that be deleted so that no carrier has any confusion as to what the decal fee is, which is the $2.50.
Welcome to the
thank
officer.
You.
All the motions have been made. The bill has been presented. I was having a bit of a dilemma. I wasn't sure if we should pass the bill and
add
the author or not, but you are here.
It's a new precedent. Thank you very much, Mr.
Would you like to make any quick comments?
No, thank you. The legislature passed this last year into law. Was signed by the governor, and as Ms. McCormick mentioned, it's just a technical change to adjust the rate so that we can conform, you know, with the broader international agreement. So pretty straightforward, and would appreciate your support.
Is there, are there any questions? Representative Kiffmeyer.
No, Mr. Chairman, I didn't.
Oh, okay, we had you on the list somehow.
Yes, there were some previous.
Any other questions? Well, seeing none, then Representative Houseman renews her motion that Senate File 757 be recommended passed and placed in the General Register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Again, members, be sure you note the bill referrals, and secondly, by way of an announcement, Hennepin Technical College, which is out the way of several of us here that would represent the western suburbs, they are having a display at the Great Hall, and they also have snacks, sandwiches, and cookies, and beverage. So you may want to stop by and you over to the house floor, or now they're going to be in the Great Hall until 1 o'clock.
And Mr. Chair, do you know anybody that works there, Vanessa?
Well, I know the one that's setting it up is one Carol Carlson. And it's a similar last name, and it is my wife, yeah.
And Mr. Chair, I do know that their culinary department has a rather ball.
I think they got a couple of students back here. Too.
That's right. The problem with the culinary department is
about
spring break, and so it wasn't their culinary department, unfortunately, it's not there. But I can give you the history on the good sandwiches as can Representative Kahn. With that being adjourned.